up for the snap. Nice, we're back in this. He struck his palm with his fist, teeth clenched, a grayish flash under the helmet. He was looking up, visualizing the game, the field, his blue and gray Patriots. My eyes dilated. I took him in deeper, the pale sweep of his jaw, his throat, the thin adolescent cords rising along its length. His shirt was off because it was summer, because it didn't matter. There were two fingers of dirt on his collarbone from earlier that afternoon, when we planted the baby apple tree in Buford's backyard. Are we close? I asked, not knowing what I meant. The voices roared, straining through the crackle. Yeah, I think we got this. He lay back, beside me, the dirt crunching under his weight. Okay, so fourth down basically means this is our last chance. Are you with me? Uh-huh. Then why are you staring at the ceiling? I'm with you. I propped my head up with my palm and faced him, his torso a faint blaze in the half-dark. I'm with you, Trev. Fourth down. Don't call me that. It's Trevor. Full and long. All right? Sorry. It's fine. Fourth down means it's all or bust. On our backs, shoulders almost touching, the thin film of heat formed between our skins as the air thickened with the men's voices, the crowd's corrosive cheers. We got this. We got this, his voice said. His lips moved, I imagined, the way they do in prayer. It seemed he could see through the roof, to the starless sky, the moon that night a gnawed bone above the field. I don't know if it was him or me who shifted, but the space between us grew thinner and thinner as the game roared on, and our upper arms grew moist, touched so lightly neither of us noticed it happening. And maybe it was there in the barn that I first saw what I would always see when flesh is pressed against the dark, how the sharper edges of his body, shoulders, elbows, chin, and nose poked through the blackness, a body halfway in or out of a river's surface. The Patriots soared through their winning touchdown. The crickets ignited across the low shifting grass around the barn. Turning to him, I felt their serrated legs through the floor beneath us as I said his name, full and long. I said it so quiet, the syllables never survived my mouth. I drew closer, toward the wet, salted heat of his cheek. He made a sound almost like pleasure. Or maybe I just imagined that. I went on, licking his chest, his ribs, the flare of hair on his pale belly, and then the heavy clank as the helmet tipped backward, the crowd roaring. In the bathroom with the pea soup walls, the grandma rolls a freshly boiled egg over the boy's face where, a few minutes ago, his mother had flung an empty ceramic teapot that exploded on the boy's cheek. The egg is warm as my insides, he thinks. It's an old remedy. The egg, it heals even the worst bruises, says his grandma. She works on the violet lump, shining like a plum on the boy's face. As the egg circled, its smooth pressure on the bruise, the boy watched under a puffed lid, his grandma's lips crease with focus as she worked. Years later, as a young man, when all that remains of the grandma is a face etched in his mind, the boy will remember that crease between her lips while breaking open a hard-boiled egg on his desk on a winter night in New York. Short on rent, it would be eggs for dinner for the rest of the week. They would not be warm, but cold in his palm, having been boiled by the dozen earlier that morning. At his desk, drifting, he'll roll the moist egg across his cheek. Without speaking, he will say, thank you. He'll keep saying it until the egg grows warm with himself. Thank you, Grandma, says the boy, squinting. You fine now, little dog. She lifts the pearly orb and places it gently to his lips. Eat, she says. Swallow. Your bruises are inside it now. Swallow, and it won't hurt anymore. And so he eats. He is eating still. There were colors, Ma. Yes, there were colors I felt when I was with him. Not words, but shades, penumbras. We stopped the truck one time on the side of a dirt road and sat against the driver door, facing a meadow. Soon our shadows on the red exterior shifted and bloomed, like purple graffiti. Two double cheese whoppers were warming on the hood, their parchment wrappers crackling. Did you ever feel colored in when a boy found you with his mouth? What if the body, at its best, is only a longing for body? The blood racing to the heart, only to be sent back out, filling the roots, the once empty channels, the miles it takes to take us toward each other. Why did I feel more myself while reaching for him, my hand mid-air, than I did having touched him? His tongue tracing my ear, the green pulled through a blade of grass. The burgers started to smoke. We let them. I would work for the farm for two more summers after that first one. But my time with Trevor would stretch through all the seasons in between. And that day, it was October 16th, a Thursday, partly cloudy, the leaves crisp but still on their branches. We had eggs sautéed in diced tomatoes and fish sauce over rice for dinner. I was wearing a gray-red plaid button-up from L.L. Bean. You were in the kitchen, washing up, humming. The TV was on, playing a rerun of Rugrats, Lon clapping to the animated show. One of the bulbs in the bathroom buzzed, the wattage too strong for the socket. You wanted to go buy new ones at the drugstore, but decided to wait for your wages from the salon so we could also get a box of Ensure for Lon. You were okay that day. You even smiled twice through the cigarette smoke. I remember it. I remember it all, because how can you forget anything about the day you first found yourself beautiful? I turned the shower off, and, instead of toweling and dressing before the steam on the door mirror cleared, like I normally would, I waited. It was an accident, my beauty revealed to me. I was daydreaming, thinking about the day before, of Trevor and me behind the Chevy, and had stood in the tub with the water off for too long. By the time I stepped out, the boy before the mirror stunned me. Who was he? I touched the face, its sallow cheeks. I felt my neck, the braid of muscles sloped to collarbones that jutted into stark ridges, the scraped-out ribs sunken as the skin tried to fill its irregular gaps, the sad little heart rippling underneath like a trapped fish, the eyes that wouldn't match, one too open, the other dazed, slightly lidded, cautious of whatever light was given it. It was everything I hid from, everything that made me want to be a son, the only thing I knew that had no shadow. And yet, I stayed. I let the mirror hold those flaws, because for once, drying, they were not wrong to me, but something that was wanted, that was sought and found among a landscape as enormous as the one I had been lost in all this time. Because the thing about beauty is that it's only beautiful outside of itself. Seen through a mirror, I viewed my body as another, a boy a few feet away, his expression unmoved, daring the skin to remain as it was, as if the sun setting was not already elsewhere, was not in Ohio. I got what I wanted. a boy swimming toward me. Except I was no shore, Ma. I was driftwood, trying to remember what I had broken from to get here. Back in the barn that first night we touched, the Patriots game at halftime through the radio, I heard him. The air was thick or thin or not there. Maybe we even drifted off for a bit. The commercials were on, crackling and buzzing through the receiver. But I heard him. We were just staring at the rafters. And then he said, casually, as if naming a country on a map, "Why was I born?" His features troubled in the waning light. I pretended not to hear. But he said it again. "Why was I even born, little dog?" The radio hissed beneath his voice, and I spoke to the air. I said, "I hate KFC," responding to the commercial on purpose. "Me too," he said without skipping a beat. And we cracked up. We cracked open. We fell apart like that, laughing. Trevor and his daddy lived alone in an Easter yellow mobile home behind the interstate. That afternoon, his old man was out laying red brick walkways for a commercial park out in Chesterfield. The white door frames in the mobile home were stained pink with fingerprints. A house colored with work, which meant a house colored with exhaustion, disrepair. The rug uprooted so no one got a clean. But the hardwood never waxed and polished. And you could feel the hammered down nails through your socks. The cabinet doors were torn off to make it easy. There was a cinder block under the sink to hold the pipes. In the living room, above the couch, was a duct tape poster of Neil Young, guitar in hand, grimacing into a song I've never heard. In his room, Trevor turned on a Sony car stereo hooked to two speakers set on a dresser, and bobbed his head as a hip-hop beat intensified through the amp. The beats were interspersed with recordings of gunshots, men shouting, a car peeling off. "Have you heard this yet? It's this new dude, 50 Cent. Trevor smiled. "Pretty dope, huh?" A bird flew past the window, making the room seem to blink. "I've never heard of him," I lied. Why, I'm not quite sure. Maybe I wanted to give him the power of this small knowledge over me. But I'd heard it before, many times, as it was played that year through endless passing cars and open apartment windows back in Hartford. The entire album, Get Rich or Die Tryin', was burned bootleg on hundreds of blank CDs bought in 40 packs for cheap from Walmart or Target, so that the whole North Side echoed with a kind of anthem of Curtis Jackson's voice fading in and out of intelligibility as you rode your bike through the streets. "I walked the block with the bundles," he recited, his hands gestured in front of him, fingers splayed. "I've been knocked on the humble, swing the ox when I rumble, show your ass what my gun do." He paced the room, rapping with purpose, gusto, frowning as spit sprayed the air, landed cool on my cheek. "Come on, man, I love this part." He mouthed the words, staring at me as if I were the camera in the music video. I followed his lips until we were singing the hook together, my shoulders swaying to the rhythm. "Many men, many, 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 many men, wish death upon me. Lord, I don't cry no more. Don't look to the sky no more. Have mercy on me." In that room, among the Star Wars poster, The Empire Strikes Back, peeling above his unmade bed, among the empty root beer cans, the 20-pound dumbbell, one half of a broken skateboard, the desk covered with loose change, empty gum packets, gas station receipts, weed crumbs, fentanyl patches and empty dime bags, coffee mugs ringed brown with old water and joint roaches, a copy of Mice and Men, empty shell casings from a Smith & Wesson. There were no questions. Under the covers, we'd made friction of each other and fiction of everything else. He had shaved his head in the sink that day, and the bits of hair pricked us everywhere we moved, our fingers lost around belt buckles. A Band-Aid, loosened from sweat and heat, hung from his elbow, its plastic film scraping my ribs as he climbed on top of me, searching. Under my fingers, the stretch marks above his knees, on his shoulders, and the base of his spine shone silver and new. He was a boy breaking out and into himself at once. That's what I wanted. Not merely the body, desirable as it was, but its will to grow into the very world that rejects its hunger. Then I wanted more. The scent, the atmosphere of him. The taste of French fries and peanut butter underneath the salve of his tongue. The salt around his neck from the two-hour drives to nowhere and a Burger King at the edge of the county. A day of tense talk with his old man. The rust from the electric razor he shared with that old man. How I would always find it on his sink in its sad plastic case. The tobacco, weed, and cocaine on his fingers mixed with motor oil. All of it accumulating into the after scent of wood smoke caught and soaked in his hair. As if when he came to me, his mouth wet and wanting, he came from a place on fire. A place he could never return to. And what do you do to a boy like that, but turn yourself into a doorway? A place he can go through again and again, each time entering the same room. Yes, I wanted it all. I drove my face into him as if into a climate, the autobiography of a season, until I was numb. "Close your eyes," he said, shaking. "Don't want you seeing me like this." But I opened them anyway, knowing that in the dim, everything looked the same. Like you're still sleeping. But in our hurry, our teeth collided. He made a hurt sound, then turned away, suddenly embarrassed. Before I could ask if he was okay, he resumed, his eyes half open as we locked, slick and smooth now, deeper, then lower, toward the waistband's elastic resistance, the snap never coming, the fabric's rustle at my ankles, my cock, the bead of moisture at its tip, the coldest thing between us. Surfacing from the sheets, his face shone through the wet mask we made of our scavenge. He was white. I never forgot this. He was always white. And I knew this was why there was a space for us. A farm, a field, a barn, a house, an hour, two. A space I never found in the city, where the tenement apartments we lived in were so cramped one could tell when a neighbor had a stomach flu in the middle of the night. To hide here, in a room in a broken-down mobile home, was somehow a privilege, a chance. He was white. I was yellow. In the dark, our facts lit us up and our acts pinned us down. But how do I tell you about that boy without telling you about the drugs that soon blew it apart? The oxy and coke. The way they made the world smolder at its tips. And then the rust-red Chevy. The one Buford gave his son, Trev's old man, when he was 24. The one the old man cherished, having repaired and replaced enough parts to make four trucks over through the years. How its windows were already blue-streaked and its tires smooth as human skin by the time we blasted through the corn, going 55 as Trevor shouted crazy, a patch of fentanyl hot on his arm, the liquid melted through its edges and dripping down his bicep like sick sap. Cocaine in our noses, our lungs, we laughed in a way. And then the swerve. A smithereen of yellow, the slam, glass skittering, the crushed hood smoking under the dead oak, a red line running down Trevor's cheek, then widening at his jaw. Then his daddy calling from the house, the rage in his scream jolting us from the seats. As the engine steamed, we felt our ribs for broken bones, then bolted out of the gasoline-reeked pickup, crossed the rest of the cornfield behind Trevor's house, past the wheelless John Deere tractor suspended on cinder blocks, the empty chicken coop with latches rusted shut, over the small plastic white fence, invisible under a choke of brambles, then through crabgrass and under the highway overpass toward the pines. Dry leaves crashing past us, Trevor's old man running toward the wrecked truck, the only car they owned, neither of us with the guts to look back. How do I tell you about Trevor without telling you again of those pines? How it was an hour after the Chevy that we lay there, the cold seeping up from the forest floor. How we sang this little light of mine until the blood on our faces grabbed around our lips and stiffened us quiet. The first time we fucked, we didn't fuck at all. I only have the nerve to tell you what comes after, because the chance this letter finds you is slim. The very impossibility of your reading this is all that makes my telling it possible. In Trevor's mobile home, there was a painting of a bowl of peaches in the hallway that always caught me. The hallway was too narrow, and you could only see it from inches away. More aftermath than art. I had to stand a little to the side to see it in full. Each time I walked by, I slowed down, taking it in. A cheap painting from Family Dollar, mass-produced with vague indications of impressionism. When I examined the brushstrokes, I saw that they were not painted on at all, but printed on with speckled relief, suggesting a hand without enacting the real. The relief strokes never cohered with their shades, so that a stroke would hold two, even three colors at once. A fake, a fraud, which was why I loved it. The materials never suggested authenticity, but rather an inconspicuous sameness, a desire to pass as art only under the most cursory glance. It hung on the wall, hidden in the gloomy hallway that led to Trevor's room. I never asked who put it there. Peaches. Pink peaches. Under the humid sheets, he pressed his cock between my legs. I spat in my hand and reached back, grabbed tight his heated length, mimicking the real thing as he pushed. I glanced back and caught the thrilled mischief in his eyes. Although this was a mock attempt, a penis in a fist in place of the inner self, for a moment it was real. It was real because we didn't have to look, as if we fucked and unfucked at a distance from our bodies, yet still inside the sensation, like a memory. We did what we had seen in porn. I wrapped my free arm around his neck, my mouth searching and taking any part of Trevor that was closest. And he did the same, pressing his nose into the crook of my neck, his tongue, his tongues. And his arms, hot along their tense muscles, reminded me of the neighbor's house on Franklin Avenue, the morning after it burned. I had lifted a piece of window frame, still warm from the wreck, my fingers digging into the soft wood, damp from the hydrant, the way I now dug into Trevor's bicep. I thought I heard the hiss of steam coming off him, but it was only October slashing outside, wind making a lexicon of the leaves. We did not speak. He fucked my hand until he shuddered, wet, like the muffler of a truck starting up in the rain. Until my palm slickened and he said, "No, oh no," as if it was blood, not semen, that was leaving him. Done with ourselves, we lay for a while, our faces cooling as they dried. Now, whenever I visit a museum, I'm hesitant to come too close to a painting, for fear of what I might or might not find there. Like the pinkish smear of Trevor's dollar store peaches, I stare instead, hands behind my back from far away, sometimes even at the room's threshold, where everything is still possible because nothing is revealed. Afterward, lying next to me with his face turned away, he cried skillfully in the dark, the way boys do. The first time we fucked, we didn't fuck at all. The boy is standing in a tiny yellow kitchen in Hartford. Still a toddler, the boy laughs, believing they are dancing. He remembers this, because who can forget the first memory of their parents? It was not until the blood ran from his mother's nose, turning her white shirt the color of Elmo he had seen on Sesame Street, that he started to scream. Then his grandmother rushed in, grabbed him, and ran past her reddening daughter, the man shouting over her, out to the balcony, then down the back steps, shouting in Vietnamese, "He's killing my girl! God, God, he's killing her!" People ran from all over, from their stoops down the block to the three-story apartment. Tony, the mechanic from across the street with the wrecked arm, Junior's father, Miguel, and Roger, who lived above the convenience store. They all rushed over and pulled the father off his mother. The ambulances came. The boy, hoisted to his grandmother's hip, watched the officers approach his father with guns drawn. How his father waved a bloody $20 bill, the way he did back in Saigon, where the cops would take the money, tell the boy's mother to calm down and take a walk, then leave as if nothing happened. The boy watched as the American officers tackled his father, the money slipping out in the tussle and landing on the sidewalk lit by sulfur lights. Focused on the brown and green money leaf on the pavement, half expecting it to fly up, back onto a winter tree, the boy did not see his father cuffed, dragged up to his feet, his head pushed into the patrol car. He saw only the crumpled money, until a neighbor girl in pigtails swiped it when no one was looking. The boy looked up to find his mother being carried out by paramedics, her broken face floating past him on the stretcher. In his backyard, an empty dirt field beside a freeway overpass, I watched Trevor aim his .32 Winchester at a row of paint cans lined on an old park bench. I did not know then what I know now. To be an American boy, and then an American boy with a gun, is to move from one end of a cage to another. He tugged at the visor of his Red Sox cap, his lips scrunched. A porch light reflected on the barrel a small white star in the faraway dark, which rose and fell as he aimed. This is what we did on nights like this. A Saturday with no sound for miles. I sat on a milk crate, sipping Dr. Pepper, and watched him empty one cartridge after another into meadow. Where the rifle's butt recoiled against his shoulder, his green whaler's t-shirt wrinkled, the creases grabbing with each shot. The cans leaped one by one off the bench. I watched, recalling a story Mr. Buford told us back on the farm. Years ago, hunting in Montana, Buford found a moose in his trap, a male. He spoke slowly, rubbing his white stubble, describing how the trap had cut off the moose's hind leg, a sound like a wet stick snapping, he said, save for a few stringy pink ligaments. The animal groaned against its body, which, bleeding and torn, was suddenly a prison. It raged, fat tongue lolling out a voice. Almost like a man's, Buford said, like you and me. He glanced at his grandson, then at the ground, his plate of beans speckled with ants. He put down his rifle, he explained, and took out the double barrel holstered to his back and steadied. But the buck noticed him and charged, tearing its leg clean off. It ran right at him before he could aim, then veered toward a clearing and broke through the trees, hobbling on what was left of itself. "Like you and me," I said to no one.
"I got lucky," Buford said. "Three legs be damned, those things can kill you."
In the backyard, Trevor and I sat on the grass, passing a joint sprinkled with crushed oxy. With the back blown clean off, only the legs remained of the bench. Four legs without a body. A week after the first time, we did it again. His cock in my hand, we began. My grip tightened around the covers. And that inertia of his skin, damped tight against my own, made the task feel not merely of fucking, but of hanging on. The inside of his cheek, where the flesh was softest, tasted like cinnamon gum and wet stones. I reached down and felt the cock slit. When I rubbed the warming globe, he shivered against himself. Out of nowhere, he grabbed my hair. My head jerked back in his grip. I let out a clipped yelp, and he stopped, his hand hovering beside my face, hesitant. "Keep going," I said, and leaned back, offering it all. "Grab it." I can't make sense of what I felt. The force and torque of pain gathered toward a breaking point, a sensation I never imagined was a part of sex. Something took over, and I told him to do it harder, and he did. He lifted me nearly off the bed by the roots of my follicles. With each slam, a light turned on and off inside me. I flickered like a bulb in a storm, seeking myself in his steering. He let go of my hair, only to put his arm under my neck. My lips brushed his forearm, and I could taste the salt concentrated there. Recognition flinched inside him. This is how we were going to do it from now on. What do you call the animal that, finding the hunter, offers itself to be eaten? A martyr? A weakling? No. A beast gaining the rare agency to stop. Yes, the period in the sentence. It's what makes us human, Ma. I swear. It lets us stop in order to keep going. Because submission, I soon learned, was also a kind of power. To be inside of pleasure, Trevor needed me. I had a choice, a craft. Whether he ascends or falls depends on my willingness to make room for him. For you cannot rise without having something to rise over. Submission does not require elevation in order to control. I lower myself. I put him in my mouth, to the base, and peer up at him, my eyes a place he might flourish. After a while, it is the cocksucker who moves. And he follows. When I sway this way, he swerves along. And I look up at him as if looking at a kite, his entire body tied to the teetering world of my head. He loves me. He loves me not, we are taught to say, as we tear the flower away from its flowerness. To arrive at love, then, is to arrive through obliteration. Eviscerate me, we mean to say, and I'll tell you the truth. I'll say yes. Keep going, I begged. Fuck me up, fuck me up. By then, violence was already mundane to me, was what I knew ultimately of love. Fuck me up. It felt good to name what was already happening to me all my life. I was being fucked up at last, by choice. In Trevor's grip, I had a say in how I would be taken apart. So I said it. harder, harder, until I heard him gasp, as if surfacing from a nightmare we swore was real. After he came, when he tried to hold me, his lips on my shoulder, I pushed him away, pulled my boxers on, and went to rinse my mouth. Sometimes being offered tenderness feels like the very proof that you've been ruined. Then, one afternoon, out of nowhere, Trevor asked me to top him, the way we had been doing it, which we now called fake fucking. He lay on his side. I spat in my palm and snuggled up to him. I was only up to his neck in height, but lying down, spooning, our heads met. I kissed his shoulders, made my way to his neck, where his hair ended, as some boys do, with the strands whittled down to a small half-inch tail at the nape. It was the part that shone like wheat tips touched by sunlight, while the rest of his head, with its fuller hair, stayed dark brown. I flicked my tongue under it. How could such a hard-stitched boy possess something so delicate, made entirely of edges, of endings? Between my lips, it was a bud sprouted from inside him. Possible. This part is the good part of Trevor, I thought. Not the squirrel shooter, not the one who axed up what was left of the shot-up park bench to splinters. The one who, in a fit of rage I can't recall the cause of, shoved me into a snowbank on our walk back from the corner store. This part, this flick of hair, was what made him stop his truck in the middle of traffic to stare at a 6-foot sunflower on the side of the road, his mouth slack. Who told me sunflowers were his favorite because they grew higher than people? Who ran his fingers so gently down their lengths I thought red blood pulsed inside the stalks? But it was over before it began. Before my tip brushed his greased palm, he tensed, his back a wall. He pushed me back, sat up. Fuck. He stared straight ahead. He spoke into the wall. I don't know. I don't want to feel like a girl, like a bitch. I can't, man. I'm sorry. It's not for me. He paused, wiped his nose. It's for you, right? I pulled the covers to my chin. I had thought sex was to breach new ground, despite terror. That as long as the world did not see us, its rules did not apply. But I was wrong. The rules, they were already inside us. Soon the Super Nintendo was on. Trevor's shoulders shook as he hammered away at the controller. Hey, little dog, he said after a while. Then, softly, still fixed on the game. I'm sorry, okay? On the screen, a tiny red Mario jumped from platform to platform. If Mario fell off, he would have to start the level over, from the beginning. This was also called dying. The boy ran away from home one night. He ran with no plans. In his backpack were a bag of Cheerios taken out the box, a pair of socks, and 2 Goosebumps paperbacks. Although he could not read chapter books yet, he knew how far a story could take him, and holding these books meant there were at least 2 more worlds he could eventually step into. But because he was 10, he made it only to the playscape behind his elementary school, 20 minutes away. After sitting on the swings for a while in the dark, the creaking chain the only sound, he climbed one of the nearby maples. The leafy branches jostled around him as he climbed. Halfway up, he stopped and listened to the neighborhood. A pop song coming from an apartment window across the lot. Traffic from the nearby freeway. A woman calling in a dog or a child. Then the boy heard footsteps on dried leaves. He pulled his knees up close and hugged the trunk. He held still and stared down, cautious, through the boughs, which were dusty and gray from the city's smog. It was his grandmother. Motionless, she looked up, one eye open, searching. It was too dark to see him. She seemed so small, a misplaced doll, as she swayed, squinting. "Little dog," she said in a whisper shout. "You up there, little dog?" She craned her neck, then looked away, at the freeway in the distance. "Your mom, she not normal, okay? She pain. She hurt. But she want you. She need us." She stirred in place. The leaves crackled. "She love you, little dog. But she sick, sick like me, in the brains." She examined her hand, as if to make sure it still existed, then dropped it. The boy, hearing this, pressed his lips to the cold bark to keep from crying. "She pain," the boy thought, mulling over her words. "How can anyone be a feeling?" The boy said nothing. "You don't need to be scared, little dog. You smarter than me." Something crinkled. In her arms, held like a baby, was a bag of Cool Ranch Doritos. In her other hand was a Poland Spring water bottle filled with warm jasmine tea. She kept muttering to herself, "You don't need to be scared. No need." Then she stopped and trained her eyes on him. They watched each other between the shivered leaves. She blinked once. The branches clacked and clacked, then stopped. "Do you remember the happiest day of your life? What about the saddest? Do you ever wonder if sadness and happiness can be combined to make a deep purple feeling? Not good, not bad, but remarkable simply because you didn't have to live on one side or the other." Main Street was empty the night Trevor and I rode our bikes down the middle of the road, our tires swallowing the fat yellow lanes as we sped. It was 7 p.m., which meant there were only 5 hours left of Thanksgiving Day. Our breaths smoked above us. With each inhale, the pungent wood fires made a bright note in my lungs. Trevor's old man was back at the trailer, in front of the football game, eating TV dinners with bourbon and Diet Coke. My reflection warped over the storefront glass as we rode. The stoplights blinked yellow, and the only sound was the clicking spokes beneath us. We rode back and forth like that, and for a stupid moment, it felt like that strip of concrete called Main Street was all we ever possessed, all that held us. Mist came down, diffracted the streetlights into huge Van Gogh orbs. Trevor, ahead of me, stood up on his bike, arms out on both sides, and shouted, "I'm flying! Hey, I'm flying!" His voice cracked as he mimicked the scene in Titanic, where the girl stands at the bow of the ship. "I'm flying, Jack," he shouted. After a while, Trevor stopped pedaling and let his bike slide to a stop, arms at his side. "I'm starving." "Me too," I said. "There's a gas station up there." He pointed to a Shell station ahead of us. Surrounded by the vast night, it looked like a spaceship had crashed on the side of the street. Inside, we watched two frozen egg and cheese sandwiches spin together in the microwave. The old white lady at the counter asked us where we were headed. "Home," Trevor said. "My mom's stuck in traffic, so just getting a snack before she comes for dinner." The woman's eyes flicked over me as she handed him the change. Trevor's mom moved to Oklahoma with her boyfriend almost 5 years ago. On the stoop of a dentist's office, across the street from a shuttered Friendly's, we unwrapped our sandwiches. Warm cellophane crinkled around our hands. We chewed, stared into the restaurant windows, where a poster of a Sunday advertised a ghastly green, colossal leprechaun mint boat from last March. I held my sandwich close, letting the steam blur my vision. "Do you think we'll still hang out when we're 100? I said without thinking. He flung the wrapper, which caught the wind and blew back atop the bush beside him. Right away, I regretted asking. Swallowing, he said, "People don't live to 100. He ripped open a packet of ketchup, squeezed a thin red line over my sandwich. "True," I nodded. Then I heard the laughter. It came from a house on the street behind us. The clear voices of children, 2, maybe 3, then a man's, a father. They were playing in the backyard. Not a game, exactly, but an embodiment of vague excitement, the kind known only to very young children, where delight rushes through them simply by running across an empty field not yet recognized as a tiny backyard in a shitty part of town. From their shrill cries, they were no older than 6, an age where one could be ecstatic just by moving. They were little bells struck to singing, it seems, by air itself. "That's enough. That's enough for tonight," the man said, at which the voices immediately faded. The sound of a screen door slamming. The quiet flooded back. Trevor beside me, his head in his hands. We rode home, the street lights here and there above us. That day was a purple day. Neither good nor bad, but something we passed through. I pedaled faster. I moved, briefly unmoored. Trevor, beside me, was singing the 50 Cent song. His voice sounded oddly young, as if it had come back from a time before I met him. As if I could turn and find a boy with a denim jacket laundered by his mom. Detergent wafting up and through his hair, still blonde above baby plump cheeks, training wheels rattling on the pavement. I joined him. Many men, many, 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 many men. We sang, nearly shouting the lyrics, the wind clipping at our voices. They say a song can be a bridge, Ma, but I say it's also the ground we stand on. And maybe we sing to keep ourselves from falling. Maybe we sing to keep ourselves. Wish death upon me. Lord, I don't cry no more. Don't look to the sky no more. Have mercy on me. In the blue living rooms we passed, the football game was dying down. Blood in my eye, dog, and I can't see. In the blue living rooms, some people won. And some people lost. In this way, autumn passed. Inside a single-use life, there are no second chances. That's a lie, but we live it. We live anyway. That's a lie, but the boy opens his eyes. The room, a gray-blue smear. There's music coming through the walls. Chopin, the only thing she listens to. The boy climbs out of bed, and the corners of the room tilt on an axis, like a ship. But he knows this, too, is a trick he's making of himself. In the hallway, where the spilled lamp reveals a black mess of broken vinyl 45s, he looks for her. In her room, the covers on the bed are pulled off, the pink lace comforter piled on the floor, the nightlight, only halfway in its socket, flickers and flickers. The piano drips its little notes, like rain dreaming itself whole. He makes his way to the living room. The record player by the love seat skips as it spins a record long driven to its end, the static intensifying as he approaches. But Chopin goes on, somewhere beyond reach. He follows it, head tilted for the source. And there, on the kitchen table, beside the gallon of milk on its side, the liquid coming down in white strings like a tablecloth in a nightmare, a red eye winking. The stereo she bought at Goodwill, the one that fits in her apron pocket as she works, the one she slides under her pillowcase during rainstorms, the nocturnes growing louder after each thunderclap. It sits in the pool of milk, as if the music was composed for it alone. In the boy's single-use body, anything's possible. So he covers the eye with his finger to make sure he's still real. Then he takes the radio. The music in his hands dripping milk, he opens the front door. It is summer. The strays beyond the railroad are barking, which means something, a rabbit or possum, has just slipped out of its life and into the world. The piano notes seep through the boy's chest as he makes his way to the backyard, because something in him knew she'd be there, that she was waiting, because that's what mothers do. They wait. They stand still until their children belong to someone else. Sure enough, there she is, standing at the far end of the little chain-link yard, beside a flattened basketball, her back to him. Her shoulders are narrower than he remembers from hours ago, when she tucked him into bed, her eyes glazed and pink. Her nightgown, made from an oversized t-shirt, is torn in the back, exposing her shoulder blade, white as a halved apple. A cigarette floats to the left of her head. He walks up to her. He walks up to his mother with music in his arms, shaking. She's hunched, distorted, tiny, as if crushed by the air alone. "I hate you," he says. He studies her to see what language can do. But she doesn't flinch. Only halfway turns her head. The cigarette, its ember bead, rises to her lips, then flutters near her chin. "I don't want you to be my mom anymore." His voice strangely deeper, more full. "You hear me? You're a monster." And with that, her head is lopped off its shoulders. No. She's bending over, examining something between her feet. The cigarette hangs in the air. He reaches for it. The burn he expects doesn't come. Instead, his hand crawls. Opening his palm, he discovers the firefly's severed torso, the green blood darkening on his skin. He looks up. It's just him and the radio, standing beside a flat basketball in the middle of summer. The dogs now silent and full. "Ma," he says to no one, his eyes filling. "I didn't mean it." "Ma," he calls out, taking a few clipped steps. He drops the radio. It falls mouth down in the dirt and turns toward the house. "Ma." He runs back inside, his hands still wet with a single-use life. Looking for her. Then I told you the truth. It was a grayish Sunday. All morning the sky had threatened downpour. The kind of day, I had hoped, where the bond between two people might be decided on easily. The weather being so bleak, we would see each other, you and I, with relief. A familiar face made more luminous than we had remembered in the backdrop of dreary light. Inside the bright Dunkin' Donuts, two cups of black coffee steamed between us. You stared out the window. Rain slashed down the road as the cars came back from church service on Main Street. "People seem to like those SUV things these days," you noted the caravan of cars at the drive-thru. "Everybody wants to sit higher and higher." Your fingers thrummed the table. "You want sugar, Ma?" I asked. "What about cream? Or actually, maybe a donut? Oh no, you like the croissants." "Say what you have to say, little dog." Your tone subdued, watery. The steam from the cup gave your face a shifting expression. "I don't like girls." I didn't want to use the Vietnamese word for it, bédé, from the French bédé, short for pedophile. Before the French occupation, our Vietnamese did not have a name for queer bodies, because they were seen like all bodies, fleshed and of one source. And I didn't want to introduce this part of me using the epithet for criminals. You blinked a few times. You don't like girls, you repeated, nodding absently. I could see the words moving through you, pressing you into your chair. Then what do you like? You're 17, you don't like anything. You don't know anything, you said, scratching the table. Boys, I said, controlling my voice. But the word felt dead in my mouth. The chair creaked as you leaned forward. Chocolate, I want chocolate. A group of children in teal oversized t-shirts, just back, judging from their paper bags full of apples, from an apple picking trip, poured into the shop, filling it with excited shrieks. I can leave, Ma, I offered. If you don't want me, I can go. I won't be a problem and nobody has to know. Ma, say something. In the cup, my reflection rippled under a small black tide. Please. Tell me, you said from behind the palm on your chin. Are you going to wear a dress now? Ma, they'll kill you. You shook your head. You know that. Who will kill me? They kill people for wearing dresses. It's on the news. You don't know people. You don't know them. I won't, Ma. I promise. Look, I never wore one before, have I? Why would I now? You stared at the two holes in my face. You don't have to go anywhere. It's just you and me, little dog. I don't have anyone else. Your eyes were red. The children across the shop were singing Old MacDonald Had a Farm. Their voices, their easy elation, piercing. Tell me, you sat up, a concerned look on your face. When did this all start? I gave birth to a healthy, normal boy. I know that. When? I was 6, in the first grade. The school I was at was a refurbished Lutheran church. With the kitchen forever under renovation, lunch was served in the gymnasium. The basketball court lines arcing beneath our feet as we sat at makeshift lunch tables. Classroom desks bunched together in clusters. Each day, the staff would wheel in huge crates filled with frozen single-dish meals, a reddish-brown mass in a white square wrapped in cellophane. The 4 microwaves we lined up behind hummed throughout the lunch period as one meal after another was melted, then pinged out, blistered and steaming, into our waiting hands. I sat down with my mush square beside a boy with a yellow polo shirt and black comb-over. His name was Gramoz, and his family, I learned later, came to Hartford from Albania after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But none of that mattered that day. What mattered was that he did not have a white square with gray mush, but a sleek turquoise lunch bag with a Velcro strap, from which he presented a tray of pizza bagels, each one the shape of oversized jewels. Want one? He said casually, biting into his. I was too shy to touch. Grimaud, seeing this, took my hand, flipped it over, and placed one in my palm. It was heavier than I imagined, and somehow still warm. Afterward, at recess, I followed Grimaud everywhere he went, 2 rungs behind him on the monkey bars, at his heels as he climbed the ladder to the yellow swirly slide, his white keds flashing with each step. How else to repay the boy who gave me my first pizza bagel, but to become his shadow? The problem was that my English, at the time, was still non-existent. I couldn't speak to him. And even if I could, what could I say? Where was I following him? To what end? Perhaps it was not a destination I sought, but merely a continuation. To stay close to Grimaud was to remain within the circumference of his one act of kindness, was to go back in time, to the lunch hour, that pizza heavy in my palm. One day, on the slide, Grimaud turned around, his cheeks puffed red, and shouted, "Stop following me, you freak! What the heck is wrong with you?" It was not the words, but his eyes, squinted as if taking aim, that made me understand. A shadow cut from its source. I stopped at the top of the slide and watched his shiny comb over grow smaller and smaller down the tunnel, before vanishing without a trace into the sound of laughing children. When I thought it was over, that I'd done my unloading, you said, pushing your coffee aside, "Now I have something to tell you." My jaw clenched. This was not supposed to be an equal exchange, not a trade. I nodded as you spoke, feigning willingness. "You have an older brother." You swept your hair out of your eyes, unblinking. "But he's dead." The children were still there, but I no longer heard their small, perishable voices. We were exchanging truths, I realized, which is to say, we were cutting one another. "Look at me. You have to know this. You wore a face, your lips a violet line." You went on. "You once had a son growing inside you. A son you had named, a name you won't repeat. The son inside you started to move, his limbs running the circumference of your belly. And you sang and spoke to him, like you did to me, told him secrets not even your husband knew. You were 17 and back in Vietnam, the same age I was, sitting across from you. Your hands cupped now like binoculars, as if the past was something that needed to be hunted down. The table wet beneath you. You wiped it with a napkin, then kept going, telling of 1986, the year my brother, your son, appeared. How, 4 months into your pregnancy, when a child's face becomes a face, your husband, my father, pressured by his family, forced you to abort him. There was nothing to eat, you went on, your chin still cupped over the table. A man on his way to the restroom asked to get by. Without looking up, you scooted over. People were putting sawdust in the rice to stretch it. You were lucky if you had rats to eat. You spoke carefully,